Well, turn with me again, please, to the passage that we read earlier on as we come this evening to our fourth study in the life of Jacob. Now, at the end of our last study, 2 weeks ago, we left Jacob in the middle of a journey. He has departed from his home and his parents at Beersheba and is making his way toward Haran, where his uncle Laban lives. Part of the reason for this journey is in order that he might find for himself a wife. His brother Esau has gone and married two local Hittite women, and we're not sure exactly what it was about these girls, but clearly they were causing all kinds of problems. They were proving a real headache. They were proving themselves most unsuitable marriage material. And so Isaac and Rebekah then are very concerned that Jacob shouldn't make the same mistake. And so part of the reason, as I say, for them dispatching Jacob off to Haran was that he might find a more choice bride than the two that his brother Esau had acquired. But there was another, more sinister reason why Jacob was making this journey. This same brother of his, Esau, wanted to kill him. Jacob had cheated Esau. He had deceived, shamefully deceived, their father Isaac, and had secured for himself the blessing that was designed for his brother. And Esau was devastated and enraged by this act of treachery, and he was determined that he was going to get his revenge. And so while the acquisition of a suitable wife was certainly part of the reason, it was a factor in Jacob's departure from Beersheba. Ultimately, it was for his own safety that he had to get as far away from that place as he possibly could. And so as Jacob sets out then on this journey, things, as we saw last time, appear to be very bleak and very depressing. On the one hand, God's plan of redemption seems to be under threat. One of the great promises, you remember, that God had given to Abraham concerned the possession of a place, the land of Canaan, which would represent a momentous reversal of what had taken place at the end of Genesis chapter 3, when, you remember, Adam and Eve had been forcibly displaced. They had been chucked out of the Garden of Eden. But you see, Canaan would be this renewed sanctuary where God's people would once again enjoy safety and security and communion with God. But here's Jacob now. And rather than possessing more of Canaan, rather than building upon what Abraham and Isaac had already secured of the land, here's Jacob, and he's packing his bags, and he's leaving Canaan. And he's leaving Canaan indefinitely. So on the one hand, God's plan of redemption seemed to be under threat. But then on the other hand, Jacob himself appeared to be a very lonely and vulnerable and forlorn figure. It's his first night away from home. He's utterly alone. He's having to sleep under the stars. He's having to resort even to using a stone for his pillow. It all seems very pathetic. It all seems very sad and very hopeless. And so, as I say, things appear very bleak and very depressing. But then, of course, as Jacob sleeps that night, God reveals to him in a dream that things aren't actually as they appear to be. And on the one hand, God's promise of redemption, God's plan of redemption isn't under threat. Far from it. There between heaven and earth is a ladder, a stairway. God is about the business of redemption still. There's this ladder, this joining between heaven and earth. And then not only that, but Jacob isn't the lonely, vulnerable, forlorn figure that he appears to be. No, on the contrary, God is with him. God is there, present in that place, so that even that unlikely wilderness destination is in fact a house of God. It's none other, Jacob says, than the gate of heaven itself. And so then, that, as I say, is where we left Jacob. He's in the middle of this journey, where things appear to be very bleak and very depressing. But in actual fact, God discloses to him, things aren't bleak and depressing at all. Things couldn't be better. My redemption is still progressing apace. And you, Jacob, are a man safe and secure with my presence with you all the time. And so, this evening then, I'd like us really just to pick up where we left off last week and to work our way through this passage that we read earlier on. And I'd like us to do so under three headings, or perhaps three headings is a rather grand term. It's really just three words which I'd like us to use to kind of prompt our thoughts. First of all then, response. That's the first word, response, in verses 18 to 22 of chapter 28. Now, Jacob sometimes gets a hard time from Bible interpreters for the way in which he responds to this dream that God gives him at Bethel. And people point particularly to his words in verses 20 to 22, where he basically says that if God will keep me safe and secure, if God will bring me back to Canaan, if he'll watch over me, if he'll keep me safe and secure, then I will own him as my God. And so Jacob then gets criticized for using that kind of language. But it seems to me that that is unfair and unjustified. And I think that two things need to be pointed out here. First of all, Jacob here is taking God's promise seriously. Jacob is taking God's promise seriously. You see, you think of Job for a minute. And you remember how Job famously exclaims, doesn't he, at one point, in the midst of his afflictions, he exclaims, "Even though God slay me, yet will I trust in him." And so you might well ask the question then, why couldn't Jacob here have shown more of that kind of attitude? Why couldn't Jacob have said, "Look, whatever God does for me, and whatever God does to me, I will trust in him. Whether or not he looks after me, whether or not he brings me safely back to the land of Canaan, even should he slay me out there in Haran, yet I will own him as my God." Why couldn't Jacob have said something like that? How come Jacob is so conditional here? How come there's all these ifs here? Why couldn't he have just said, like Job did, "Look, whatever God does to me, even if he slays me, I will own him as my God"? Well, it seems to me that we have to recognize there's actually a huge difference between Job's situation and Jacob's situation. You see, Job hadn't been promised safety and security. Now, we know, of course, don't we, as readers of the book of Job, we know right the way from chapter 1 that in actual fact God has stipulated to Satan that he mustn't lay a finger on Job's life. He can do what he likes to Job's possessions, but he must not lay a finger on Job's life. But Job doesn't know that. Job hasn't received any such promise of exemption from any kind of suffering. He hasn't received any promise of immunity even from death itself. For all he knows, he might well die, such are his afflictions. For all he knows, these afflictions he's suffering might well climax in nothing less than death itself. And so he was right to say, even if that does happen, even if God does slay me, yet will I trust in him. But you see, Jacob's in a different situation. Because Jacob has been promised quite explicitly in verse 15, in the middle of his dream, that God would watch over him, that God would remain with him, and that God would return him safely to the land of Canaan. And Jacob understands, you see, that whenever God has made a promise about something, you can hold him to that promise. And Jacob understands that resting on the platform of a divine promise, you can address God with the kind of boldness with which you would never dream of addressing Him in any other circumstances. You can say to God, Lord, you must do this for me. You must do that for me. You've promised it. You have no choice. You have no option. For you to do otherwise would be to utterly discredit yourself. For you to do otherwise would be to put yourself on a par with the unreliable, unrighteous, unpredictable gods of the pagan nations. Jacob understands that. He takes a divine promise seriously. And I think there are tremendous pastoral implications in that for us. If I have some illness, I'm permitted, I think, to go to God and to pray for healing. But I can't hold God to it because He hasn't promised healing of that illness. But if, on the other hand, I'm confessing my sins to God and I'm praying for forgiveness, I can hold God to that because He's promised it. Or if I'm in the middle of temptations and I'm praying to God for grace and mercy in my time of need, I can hold Him to that because He's promised it. Or if I'm praying that God will persevere, that God will preserve me and grant me perseverance right up until the very end of my Christian discipleship, right up until the day I die, I can hold Him to that because He's promised it. And if I'm praying for the extension of God's kingdom and the global triumph of the gospel, I can hold Him to that because He's promised it. And I think it would be a very good thing then for us to learn from Jacob in taking divine promises seriously and holding God to them and using them as a platform for the kind of bold language that Jacob felt able to use here. So that's one thing I think we should point out here. Jacob takes God's promise seriously. But the other thing is that Jacob wants to serve God in the future. Jacob wants to serve God in the future. You see, again, we could contrast Jacob unfavorably with Job here. And we could say, Job was a much more spiritual man than Jacob. Job wanted to go and be with God in heaven. And so Job didn't care what happened to him. Though he slay me, I will trust in him. Job was focused on the next life. Job was focused on being with God in glory. Whereas Jacob, on the other hand, he just wanted to have a long life of swanning around in Canaan. And so that's why he was so anxious that God should keep him safe and secure. He just wanted to live a long life in this world. He just wanted to enjoy life and to live it up a bit in the land of Canaan. We could think something like that. But in actual fact, that's not the case, is it? Jacob didn't want God to keep him safe and secure in order that he could swan around in Canaan for many years to come. Jacob wanted God to keep him safe and secure in order that he might have further opportunities in the future to serve God. For one thing, he wanted to erect an altar to God. At this point, however, it seems that he can't do that, perhaps because of the time constraints. Esau may well be chasing him, and he needs to get on. He's a refugee. He needs to get to the land of Haran, and he hasn't got time, perhaps, at this point, to erect an altar to God. He wants to do that, and he will do it. He will erect an altar to God at Bethel in Genesis chapter 35. And he wants to have that opportunity, and that's one reason why he wants God to preserve him. This stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. He wants that opportunity to worship God at a proper altar at Bethel at some point in the future. And not only that, but he wants to be able to give to God a tenth of all he's got. Well, he can't do that here because he hasn't got anything. He's literally a homeless, penniless refugee. He's got nothing. Nothing to give God in response to his kindness and grace to him. And he wants the opportunity in the future to give to God. All that you give me, I will give you a tenth. And this, then, I think, is why Jacob so wants wants to be kept safe and secure. Not because he just wants to enjoy life, but because he wants further opportunity to serve God. He feels that his present opportunities to serve God are very limited because of his circumstances. And he wants to be able in the future to erect an altar and worship God properly there, and to be able to give to God a tenth of all his possessions. Didn't the Apostle Paul feel something a little bit similar when he writes those words in the first chapter of Philippians? Remember, he writes there those well-known words. If I am to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far, but it is more necessary for you that I remain in the body. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain, and I will continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith, so that through my being with you again, your joy in Christ Jesus will overflow on account of me. Paul has a sense of unfinished business. He wants future opportunities to serve God in ministering to these Philippian believers. And Jacob here too, I think, has a sense of unfinished business. He wants to be able to serve God in the way that his heart really desires here. That's a challenge to us, isn't it? We perhaps pray often for our health, that God will keep us safe, that God will grant us prolonged health, physical and mental health. And we ought to be asking the question, why are we praying that? Why are we asking for that? Is it because simply we want to live a long life on this earth so that we can see our children and our grandchildren and we can really enjoy a long life here? Or is it because, like Jacob and like Paul, we want to have further opportunities to serve him? That should be the reason why we want to wake up still alive tomorrow morning. That should be the reason why we want to be still here in a month's time. It shouldn't be for selfish reasons. It should be because we want further opportunities to serve God. We have a sense of unfinished business. There's still work to be done. I think Jacob had something like that. So that's the first thing we see then in this passage. Jacob's response. Not, I feel, the unworthy response that some people attribute to him. But it seems to me a very adequate and a very commendable response. He's taking God's promise seriously, and he's wanting to serve God in the future. But secondly then, regression. Regression. In verses 1 to 15 of chapter 29. And I use that word partly because I wanted all my words to begin with the same letter, but also for a more adequate reason than that, that we see here, I think, a contrast between this passage and the kind of parallel passage from a generation earlier in chapter 24. In chapter 24, we have Isaac, Jacob's father, going off to this same place, Haran, to find a wife. Or in actual fact, of course, it's not Isaac in person, but his servant goes as his representative. And because then, as I say, these are kind of parallel passages, there are lots of similarities. And yet, what stands out, I think, is not so much the similarities as the differences. There's a real contrast, I think, between chapter 24 and this first half of chapter 29. And the contrast is basically this, that God is so present in the narrative in chapter 24, and yet so absent in the narrative in chapter 29. So you might want to flick over the pages every now and again. So in chapter 24 then, Isaac's servant, he arrives in Haran. He's gone there to find a wife for... Sorry, it's Abraham's servant, really. But Abraham's servant arrives in Haran. He's gone there to find a wife for Isaac. And he arrives there. And what does he do? What's the first thing that this servant does when he arrives at Haran? Verse 12 of chapter 24. he prayed. Then he prayed, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, give me success today and show kindness to my master Abraham. See, I'm standing beside this spring. And so he goes on. That's the first thing he does. He prays. He prays that God will grant success to this, his mission. Here in chapter 29, Jacob arrives at Haran. Does he pray? Does he get down on his knees? Does he cry out to God that this mission will be successful? No hint of that whatsoever. But then not only that, you go back to chapter 24, and God's providence is remarkable, isn't it? That we read in verse 15, before he had finished praying, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder. The very woman that is going to be in God's design, in God's plan, Isaac's wife, she comes out straight away. She comes out to that scene. The servant doesn't have to go looking for her. She comes out there. And rightly then, we read in verse 26, that what does the servant do? He bows down and worships the Lord, saying, Praise be to the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not abandoned his kindness and faithfulness to my master. The servant immediately recognized, wow, this is God being so good, bringing this girl out straight away, that straight away my mission is being successful. And here in chapter 29, again, God's providence is remarkable in the same way. Because again, we read in verse 9, don't we, that while Jacob is still engaged in his initial conversation with the shepherds at the well, while he was still talking with them, Rachel came. And again then, God is being so good. Again, Jacob doesn't have to go looking for this woman that he's eventually going to marry. Again, God brings her out to him, even when he's only just arrived there on the scene. But does Jacob respond like that servant? Does he get down on his knees and say, Oh Lord, you have been so kind and so faithful to me? Not a hint that that's what happens. But then back in chapter 24, we read, don't we, that once Rebekah has come out and has met Isaac's Abraham's servant, she runs back to her household, doesn't she? And we read then in verse 29 that Rebekah had a brother named Laban, and he hurried out to the man at the spring. And look at what he says at verse 31. These are his opening words to Abraham's servant, Come, you who are blessed by the Lord. Immediately Laban recognizes that Abraham's household is a blessed household, and that this servant, therefore, is someone who is blessed and who should be treated as such. He recognizes God's hand in this whole business. His first words are, Come, you who are blessed by the Lord. In other words, Laban indicates right from the word go that he is going to acquiesce and comply with this whole business because he recognizes God's hand in it all. But you go back to chapter 20, you go then to chapter 29, and again then Laban comes on the scene. And of course Laban now is fulfilling the role not of a brother but of a father. And we read then in verse 13, that he goes out, he does embrace Jacob, he does kiss Jacob, he does bring him to his home, and Jacob tells him all these things. We read, Then Laban said to him, You are my own flesh and blood. I wonder if there's almost a begrudging tone in that, but almost as if I better take you in, I better receive you, you're my own flesh and blood. But whether or not that's the case, certainly there's a contrast, isn't there, to the way in which he'd received Abraham's servant those years earlier. Come, you who are blessed of the Lord. Here it's simply, you are my flesh and blood. It seems that no longer does he recognize God's hand in this situation. Jacob has just told him everything in verse 29, in verse 13, sorry. He must have told him about the vision at Bethel. He must have told him about the dream. He must have told him that God had appeared to him and that he had had an encounter with God and that he was the heir of the promises. He must have told Laban that. And yet Laban doesn't make any reference to it. It's simply, you're my own flesh and blood. Doesn't say, Wow, you are someone whom God has favored. You are someone upon whose life is God's sovereign hand. No, simply, you're my flesh and blood. He appeals to a very carnal, a very earthly reason why he should take Jacob in. And then it gets worse, doesn't it, in terms of what we see of Laban in chapter 29. Because in verse 15, we read these words, that after Jacob had been there a month, Laban said to him, "Just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be." This is his own nephew. And yet he's speaking in such economic terms, isn't he? What will your wages be? It's his own family, his own flesh and blood, as he himself has said. And yet, he's such a businessman. He's saying, "What will your wages be?" And so it seems to me that there are two sad things then that emerge from this passage when you contrast it with chapter 24. One is that there's a compartmentalism in Jacob. That's a bit of a mouthful. What I mean is this, that he's just had this spiritual high point, hasn't he, in chapter 28. He's just had this encounter with God. And he's responded to that, as we've seen, in a very appropriate fashion. He's responded to it by expressing understanding, and by expressing appreciation, and by expressing commitment to God's purposes. And yet here we are now, once he's arrived in Haran, and that kind of sense of God's hand being in all this has gone. No longer, he's not praying to God now. He's not getting down on his knees now. He's not talking now about the Lord being his God. There seems to be such a change in this man from his demeanor at Bethel to his demeanor now at Haran. There, he was in this encounter with God. It was a spiritual high point. And he was very conscious of God and very conscious of God's purposes and God's presence. But here now in Haran, there's just no reference to God. And he's so unlike Abraham's servant a generation earlier. No prayer, no thankfulness. Seemingly no sense of God being in this at all. And I think that's such a lesson to us, isn't it? We too can be like that. We can compartmentalize things. So that here in church on a Sunday, we're very conscious of God. And we pray a lot, and we sing a lot, and we talk a lot about God. And we're very conscious of his reality and his existence and his rule in our lives. But then when we go into the week, and we're embroiled in our work, and we have big decisions to make, and big deadlines to meet, and all the rest of it, then suddenly that consciousness of God goes out the window, and we're just like everyone else at work. We're just doing things on the basis of our own impulses and our own decisions, and we're not praying and we're not thanking God. And there's no sense of our lives being caught up in his sovereign purpose. It's a very real danger, this danger of compartmentalizing things. So that yes, in those parts of our life that we label spiritual, then we talk a lot about God and we're conscious of him. But in other areas of our lives, work, in the house perhaps, in the neighborhood, then he goes out of the window. That seems to be what happens with Jacob here. But then the other sad thing here, not only this compartmentalism in Jacob, but this decline in Laban. A generation ago, he had been so full of God. He had come along and his first words to that servant of Abraham were, "Come, you who are blessed of the Lord." But now he seems a mere shadow of his former self. Now he seems to be cold. And now he seems to be a real businessman who can only think in economic terms. What will your wages be for me, Jacob? Or what will my wages be for you, sorry? I suppose a generation ago he was a young man whose father, Bethuel, was still alive, still probably was in charge of things. Laban, doubtless, had a role in looking after sheep and looking after his father's land and all that kind of thing. But he didn't have the responsibility which at that point his father Bethuel would have been exercising. But here now, you see, a generation later, Laban is now doubtless in charge of the property and the land and the estate, the animals. And it seems that he's become now then a businessman, and his heart has gone cold in terms of the Lord. And that's a danger to us as well, isn't it? A warning to us, rather. When we're students, perhaps, young people, without too much responsibility in life, it's very easy then to be full of devotion to the Lord and to be spontaneous like Laban in talking about him and recognizing his hand in things. But then as we get older and responsibilities come in, we're earning wages, we're running homes, we're looked up to by people, we need to supply food for our tables, then we become more hard and more businesslike, and that sense of devotion to the Lord evaporates. We must watch out for that. And so that's the second thing that we see then in this passage. We see Jacob's response, and then we see this regression, that things have declined from a generation ago. Jacob has begun to compartmentalize things here, and Laban has declined from back then. But then thirdly and finally, romance. Romance in verses 16 to 30. Because we all know this part of the story well, don't we? It's the most famous part of it, where Jacob falls in love with beautiful Rachel, and he works then 7 years to get her as his bride. And then, of course, when eventually the time comes, Laban, instead of giving him Rachel, gives him the ugly sister, Leah. And so then Jacob, of course, is aggrieved, but agrees to work another 7 years. And at the start of the 7 years, he gets a second wife then, Rachel. And so at the end of the passage, Jacob has worked 14 years for Laban, and he has two wives. Well, what can we take from this part of the passage? Well, let me just bring out one or two things. First of all, we see here, I think, God teaching Jacob. God teaching Jacob. I'm sure that on that morning, when Jacob woke up and realized that he had married not beautiful Rachel, but Leah, he must have known, like never before, how Isaac, his father, had felt on the day that he realized that he had just blessed Jacob, not his beloved son Esau. Jacob here was getting nothing less than a taste of his own medicine, wasn't he? He had cheated his father Isaac. And he had brought to Isaac that pain of realizing that he had been cheated. And here now Jacob himself is experiencing that pain of having been cheated. Laban has done to him what he had done to Isaac back then. And, you know, I think God often perhaps teaches us that kind of lesson. And we would do well to learn it so that when we are insulted by people, and we feel how much that hurts, we ought to remember at that point how we have insulted other people and they must have hurt in that same way. When we are ignored by people and it hurts, we ought to remember how we have ignored people and it must have hurt them. When we are wronged by people and it hurts, we ought to remember how we have wronged others and it must have hurt them in the same way. We saw this morning, didn't we, do to others as you would have them do to you. And Jacob here, I think, was being taught by God that lesson. He had caused pain to his father Isaac, and God here was showing him that by giving him the same kind of pain. Let's always, in the midst of our own pains, be asking the question, have I caused similar pain in someone else perhaps many years ago, perhaps quite recently. And we ought to be humbled by that and seeking that person's forgiveness and God's forgiveness, of course, as well. So we see God teaching Jacob here. For another thing, we see here God exemplifying love. God exemplifying love. Because we have that wonderful phrase, don't we? At the end of verse 20, that Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. It's so different, isn't it, to what we often hear in our society today. So often, when marriages break up today, we hear that it was because the couple were under stress. They were under pressure. He had lost his job. She was having to travel with her work. He had had some kind of ill health. Whatever it might be, we were under pressure. And under that pressure, our marriage just couldn't survive. Our marriage buckled under the strain of those circumstances. Now, don't get me wrong. I know that we ought to do all that we can to protect our marriages and to make sure that they are not put under unnecessary pressure. And yet at the same time, ought not true love, rather than buckling under pressure, ought it not to swallow up and belittle pressures and strains and adversities? That's what we see here with Jacob's love for Rachel. 7 years of having to work hard on the land for her. You'd have thought that would be far too big a pressure for his love for her to survive under. You'd have thought that would have definitely buckled his love for her. How could his love survive those 7 years of labor? But you see, his love, it did the opposite. It swallowed up the difficulty. It belittled the difficulty. It seemed like only a few days to him, those 7 years, because of his love for her. And you see, that is what love should do. Rather than buckling under difficulties, it should swallow up and belittle difficulties. And we, as Christians, in our marriages, we ought to be showing society what true love is. We ought to be showing society that the love God puts between a man and a woman, it doesn't buckle when pressures come. It swallows up those pressures. It makes molehills out of mountains. So we see here God teaching Jacob. We see here God exemplifying love. But then finally, we see God reversing trends. Think of Leah in this passage. Poor old Leah. She's the ugly sister. And just as it is today so often, back then too, if you didn't have the looks that society treated as being desirable, then you were overlooked. You were neglected. You suffered for that. And here she is, and Jacob has come on the scene, and she's utterly overlooked because she is the ugly sister. But she's not overlooked by God. God didn't care that she might have been ugly, that she might not have had Rachel's beautiful eyes and Rachel's beautiful figure. God didn't care about that. Other people might have done. Other people might have overlooked Leah, but God didn't overlook her. No, on the contrary, God honored Leah remarkably. Leah, this unlikely woman, the overlooked, neglected sister, she was to become the mother of several of the patriarchs, including Levi and Judah, the priestly tribe and the kingly tribe, the very line from which indeed the Messiah would eventually come. Leah, the unlikely, overlooked, neglected sister, was honored by God and was given this role of being the mother of the patriarchs. God didn't care that she might not have met society standards of being acceptable and cool and trendy. God didn't care. And God used this woman in a remarkable way in the ongoing progress of his redemptive plan. And I think it raises the question for us with which I want to conclude tonight. What matters more What do you want more? Do you want to have those credentials that society counts as important? Do you want to have the good looks and the fashionable clothes and the image that society counts as so important? That will get you noticed and that will get attention drawn to you as you go about, as you walk down the street and so on? Or do you want to be used in God's purposes? Leah didn't have anything of the former, but she had a bag full of the latter. She became a mother of the patriarchs. And that's what we should aim for. Not for what this world counts as beautiful and as desirable and as acceptable. But we should want this. We should want to be used by God. We should want to be useful to Him. We should want to have a role in His purposes. And that is what God gave in His grace to Leah. And He will give it in His grace to us as His people. And we should want that more than anything that the world can ever offer. Amen.